Hi, welcome to Camera Dojo, the official podcast of CameraDojo.com, where we help you make the most out of your photography. This is your host, Kerry Garrison, and not with me at the moment, but coming up will be David Esquire, and we're going to be talking to Michael Clark, an adventure sports photographer who has taken some amazing photographs of different adventure sports, climbing, bicycling, you name it. He's taken shots of it. And we're going to follow along on some of the images on his website. So you might want to bring up MichaelClarkPhoto.com if you can and follow along as we talk about some of the images. New on CameraDojo.com this week is an article on DSLR Remote Pro. This is the program that I use for shooting tethered with my Canon cameras. So I've talked about it before. I've talked about it in the show a bunch of times, but new version has come out and I want to take a look at it and use it with my 50D. It is super, super cool. So we're just going to go ahead and get into it. We'll take a short break and when we get back, we'll be on with Michael Clark. We are here with Michael Clark from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Michael has got some incredible sports photography on his site. He's done a number of other things. He's got a couple books, but Michael, why don't you go ahead and give us your background and a little bio on yourself?
Well, I consider myself an adventure sports photographer, meaning that I shoot like outdoor action sports, like, you know, rock climbing, surfing, mountain biking, kayaking, stuff like that. Pretty much what are often termed extreme sports, but I wouldn't necessarily call them extreme sports, though a few of them are. I've been shooting since 1995 professionally, starting in Europe and then moving back to the States. And I travel the world. I spend probably 6 months on the road each year shooting for different clients, and I have a range of clients in both the editorial and commercial worlds, anywhere from, you know, Nike and Adobe and Nikon to National Geographic and Outside and Men's Journal on the editorial side, and then I also shoot a fair bit of stock. So I'm fairly well diversified, and I've written a couple books, so I'm massively diversified.
Diversification's good.
Which is good for this economy these days, so.
Of all those things, which is your favorite?
Well, there's nothing like getting a really cool, exciting assignment, be it editorial or commercial. Sometimes it comes from both sides. Shooting stock, you know, can be fun because you get to shoot what you want to shoot to some degree. And that's where you can really experiment and do stuff, which is nice. Do stuff that you wouldn't normally do. So I tend to experiment a lot on assignment as well, especially with digital these days. And there's nothing like a great adventure. I have been having this ongoing shoot that I do down in Patagonia covering an adventure race that's just wild adventures in the middle of nowhere. And that's been happening for a couple of years. Looks like it's going to continue. So it just depends on the assignment or what's happening.
The adventure sports stuff that you have is just stunning. I mean, that is just some really, really cool stuff. How do you get some of these shots? I mean, are you hanging off the edge of cliffs like these guys are?
Yeah, I started out as a rock climbing photographer specifically because that was one of my passions. And that's what pretty much got me back into photography, actually, is shooting or rock climbing. I started rock climbing right after college, dropped out of grad school, and started traveling the world climbing, and I brought my camera along, and that's kind of what, you know, pushed me into professional photography, because I thought, well, I'm getting some pretty good stuff while I'm climbing mountains or hanging off cliffs, photographing my buddies rock climbing. Let's try and give this a go as professional. So basically, for that kind of stuff, you put up ropes and you get up there with the climbers, maybe 100 feet off the ground, maybe 1,000 feet off the ground, and start snapping away. And that's a lot of work for that one, that type of photography. And then, you know, mountain biking and kayaking and some of that stuff's a little more civilized because you're standing on the ground. So sometimes I still rig up ropes for some of that stuff just to get weird perspectives and angles.
Wow. What kind of gear are you shooting with?
In terms of camera stuff? Okay, yeah. It's Nikons mostly. And then I do shoot a little bit of medium format, but not a whole lot for the action sports stuff. So I have the D700s and D300 as a backup. I've kind of eschewed the bigger cameras just because it's lightweight. It's kind of a big deal when you're carrying all your gear way back in the middle of nowhere. And usually I'm carrying, you know, sometimes with a rock climbing up to like 120-pound packs with ropes and hardware. And then a few cameras and lenses on top of that. So just, you know, a bigger, heavier camera doesn't necessarily help me out a whole lot.
What you're doing is certainly on the far side of where a lot of people are trying to get started shooting their kids playing baseball. But, I mean, there's certainly a progression in there. But what do people really need to know to get started with getting good action shots?
That's a good question. One of the things I always kind of harp on, and it depends on what you're shooting, obviously, and the autofocus in these cameras has gotten better than it has in a long time, but still you need a pretty high-end camera with decent autofocus if you want to get a pack-sharp images. You know, even if you're just shooting your kid's soccer game, I don't have much experience with like Nikon's lower-end cameras, like the D5000 and D80 or something, so I don't know exactly how good the autofocus is there. For Nikon stuff, at least, it might depend more on the lens than it does on the camera. But I'm sure they autofocus fairly well. But if you have a higher-end camera like a D300, at least, you'll probably get it more keepers than you would if you have a lower-end camera. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is to start shooting because you'll learn. And it depends also on, you know, how into it you are. If you're just shooting, you know, and, oh, that's great, whatever, then you're probably not going to progress that much. But if you really start looking at your pictures and start looking at what's out there, like on Flickr, I mean, there's so much good photography on Flickr these days. It's amazing from amateur photographers.
For the action shots, are you shooting in shutter priority?
I tend to shoot in manual all the time, actually. And if I go into an auto mode, it's usually after priority just because that's what I'm used to from back in the old days with my Nikon F3, since that was the first auto priority mode out there. Shutter priority, I don't really use that very often unless I'm really concerned about the shutter speed. And program mode, I never use. I think manual just gives you full control of the camera, just like a six-shift car would.
And we have to ask you the obvious question, RAW or JPEG?
Oh, RAW, sure. Forget JPEG.
Okay, we can keep talking then.
All right.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of a snob when it comes to quality, so you know, I want the most the camera can give me. But, you know, I understand if you're the soccer mom shooting your kids, you don't have 3 days to process your images afterwards. So in that respect, I probably spend more time in front of the computer than I do out there actually shooting because I've got all these images to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, some of this... Oh, go ahead, David.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Gary.
No, go.
No, go ahead. You know, it's, age before beauty, I guess.
Well, I lost my train of thought, so go
ahead. what do you guys shoot? Are you guys raw shooters?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Just
making sure who I'm talking to here.
But we're Canon Knights, so.
Yeah, well, Canon makes some fantastic cameras, you know. Thank goodness Nikon came around here.
Oh, I mean, there's nothing wrong with Nikon gear. It's awesome. I mean, there's no doubt. And David just upgraded to the 5D Mark II, and I'm shooting with the 50D, and we're loving them. It's great gear.
I'm jealous of that 5D Mark II because I've seen the video, and it's pretty phenomenal. And, I'm hoping Nikon comes back in with some decent video quality here.
I have a feeling they will. I mean, they both seem to frog each other like every 18 months, roughly.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll have something even this fall that'll have the same quality video as the Canon. So we'll see what happens.
Well, when you're out on these location shots in the middle of nowhere or up on a cliff, what are you doing with your images? Are you processing them that night? Are you making backups in the field? How are you making sure that those shots are safe?
It depends on where I'm at. You know, sometimes if it's just a day shoot at a climbing area, I can have my laptop back at camp or back at wherever we're staying, and then I can back up the images onto hard drives there. If it's a more extended expedition or something like, you know, going down the Grand Canyon on a rafting trip where I'm not going to take a laptop, then I'll take a couple of these Epson, like, you know, little photo viewer things, where I can drop the cards into there and back them up onto these portable hard drives. And sometimes when I'm shooting these massive expedition races, I mean, you just don't back stuff up for 3 or 4 days. You're in the middle of nowhere, and you're going so lightweight that you can't carry any little backup device. I mean, honestly, those compact flash cards are about the safest form of storage on the planet right now. I could tell some stories, but I mean, you can crack that thing in 4 places and still not really lose any pictures from stories I've heard from Lexa and a few other people. So, safer than film was back in the day, I'll say that much at least.
Yeah.
Oh. But
yeah.
Definitely. Gosh. And then, you know, in terms of processing images, I'm not really shooting for newspapers or anything like that, so the clients don't need the images. Well, sometimes they do, but often, you know, I've got like a week or so when I get back to really edit them tightly and really work them up to perfection.
About how many photos do you typically shoot?
That just depends too, you know. If I'm shooting, like, let's say I'm shooting one rock climbing route, I'll probably shoot like 200 pictures in 165 feet. Might shoot a little more. If I'm shooting mountain biking, you know, usually that's at 8 or 9 frames a second, so you're just blasting. I think I shot for Adobe Lightroom 3 or 4 years ago. We shot 4,000 images in one day, which is about 35 gigabytes with a 12-megapixel camera. And then I just recently, this last adventure race I shot, in 10 days I shot 10,000 pictures, which was a nightmare to edit. But, you know, and there was no, like, I wasn't shooting a lot at 8 frames a second for that one, so... That was just individual shots here and there.
That race looks intense.
Yeah, that race is pretty insane.
And there's kayaking, there's biking. Looks like there's a number of different elements to this that require you to have a bunch of different skill sets in order to get some of these. I mean, some of them look like really nice portraits, where some of them are high energy action shots and others are hanging off a cliff doing something. So it looks like it really draws in a lot of different skill sets to do a particular shoot like that.
Definitely. I mean, that's where, you know, I'm not unique to this, but, you know, as an adventure sports photographer, you definitely have to be able to hang with the athletes in whatever they're doing. So if it's climbing, you got to be able to climb and be safe. If it's surfing, you need to know what you're doing. I'm not a surfer, so I wouldn't necessarily call myself a surfing photographer, but though I've shot a bit of surfing. But, you know, if you're going to swim out there in some big waves at Pipeline, you better know what you're doing or you're going to get killed. So there's just, you know, for each sport, it's also just like any other sport. If you're shooting football, you know, you got to be able to anticipate, okay, the quarterback's going to this guy because he's in the best position, and prepare yourself for that shot, otherwise you'll totally miss it. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense to me.
So, I mean, most people that do what I do, they've done these sports before, or they're really into them, because there's not really any other way you could, especially the rock climbing stuff, you're just not going to, you got to have the skills to be there.
Yes, no, that's not for me. Not that I don't want to. I'm just saying, it's not for me. Now, put me in a helicopter with a long lens so I can shoot the guy on the hill, no problem. I'm so there. But climbing the mountain right next to the guy, yeah, not going to happen.
Yeah, well, actually, I had an assignment from Men's Fitness last year. And because I shoot this lot of rock climbing stuff, I went out and shot with these guys in Sonoma County in Santa Rosa, this helicopter search and rescue team called Henry One. And they had me hanging off the bottom of the helicopter, like, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 feet over the ocean. We did crazy stuff, cliff rescues. You know, it was great. And, you know, because of my rock climbing skills, that didn't really feel all that dangerous, so it might have been way more dangerous than I knew. But it was surely fun, that's for sure.
It's when you get back and you look at a shot and you're like, what was I thinking, right?
Well, there's definitely some fear involved on some of the, especially the rock climbing stuff, because I've had some very close calls where I've nearly died. Definitely.
Now, how are you lighting these things? I mean, is it all natural light, or are you being able to throw flash? What's the best way to get some of these? Because it seems like you have the whole gamut here, and it's really hard to tell exactly where the lighting's coming from, or is it just all natural?
There's definitely some lit pictures in there, and, you know, a lot of it's natural. The portraits, a lot of them are lit, especially those black and white high contrast portraits on my website. And then some of the rock climbing images are lit. That one in the cave is definitely lit. You know, and that's where you're just hauling Ranger. I've got a Linchrome Ranger strobes that I haul up into these caves or haul way back into the backcountry. And some things you can light and some things you can't. So it's just a matter of what I can do to make it a little bit better image, and how much work or how many assistants I have to help me out to make it happen.
Because there's one shot where it looks like you're looking out of a cave and a guy is hanging in the middle over the opening. And that looks like there's a hidden flash somewhere that's going up into the mouth of the roof of this cave.
Yeah, it's number 5 in the Adventure Gallery.
Uh-huh.
There's 2 strobes in there. And, you know, there's 200 pounds of gear I hiked up into that cave with 2 strobes. One's pointed directly at the climber, and it's got a grid spot on him, so that's why it fades out pretty tightly in that upper right corner. And then there's another one lighting the left part of the cave, and I'm shooting with a fisheye lens. So
where would those flashes be located when we're looking at this image?
They're both to my left, so camera left. And one's just like maybe 10 feet away from me with the grid spot point of the climber, and the other one lighting the far side of the cave is maybe 20 feet to my left.
Okay, so they're plane with the camera or behind it. They're not like hidden behind that big rock up in the bottom left.
Yeah, they're on light stands on the ground. Since this is a cave, it's a pretty small cave, actually. The fisheye makes it look bigger than it is. And since I'm using a fisheye, they're definitely behind me, because it's seeing everything in the plane of the lens. And we just waited till sunset so that the clouds would have some color in the background. And, you know, like every sunset shoot when you're using strobes, you got to move pretty fast because the light's only going to be there for 10 or 15 minutes for the really good light.
Yeah, and which brings up another one, another one of my favorites is number 9 in that series with the guys on a mountain bike coming off a cliff. And I'm hoping people are going to follow along. I'll mention the website, and there'll be notes or links in the show notes so they can try and follow along with these. But this, this number 9, he's coming off the cliff. It looks really well frozen in time right there. It's a great shot. You know, what would go into this one? Would there be lighting to keep it up? It looks like it's an evening shot. It looks kind of warm.
It's actually the crack of dawn. The sun is probably not even fully over the horizon. It's like half of it up, and it's just all natural light. And basically, he was warming up for a jump that he was going to do later that day on this little cliff. And I just kept shooting with the motor drive 8 frames a second just as he popped over this little rise. So there's not a whole lot technically to this image. It's just framing it up and making sure he's in focus. Let me see if I can...
But I would say with this one, because you wanted to get that kind of a sense of movement, but without any motion blur per se, you had to go with a really fast shutter speed so that you're catching him without, you're not panning like some of your other shots where you're trying to show motion. This is a very still shot. So the only way to get this would be with a high shutter speed.
Definitely, and I had to crank the ISO up pretty high on this one, probably 800 or even 1250, I think. This was shot with a Nikon D2X 3 or 4 years ago, but it's high ISO that allowed me to get a shutter speed to freeze this, because there wasn't a lot of light there, actually. If you actually go to image number 14 in that gallery, the right picture is what he was warming up for. Which this is a pretty famous jump in the mountain biking world or free riding world. It's like a 40-foot drop onto a slick rock.
Yeah, it looks just like a really bad idea.
Yeah, and if you mess up on that, you're going to be in the hospital for a long time.
Let's just jump off a four-story building onto the asphalt. Yeah, that's exactly. A great idea.
Well, the asphalt is tilted, but still.
Wow.
Yeah, you wouldn't catch me doing that.
Now, the one that's on the left of the rock climber there, again, is that all natural light on that?
That's all natural light. We actually got up at the crack of dawn to get these pictures, and this is a new kind of sub-sport within the rock climbing genre called deep water soloing, or cycloblock, where they basically climb above the ocean with no ropes. So they're free soloing, and the cliff is about 100 feet tall. He's, at this point, like 70 feet off the water, and he can barely hold on to these holds, and it's actually overhanging. I don't know if that's, you can tell that in the picture. But he's got to jump like 5 feet to this next hold. And if he misses it, he's going to go 70 feet up, from 70 feet up all the way into the ocean. And there's like 10-foot waves rolling in below him. It's deafening. I could barely even talk to him at this point.
Now, does that go into the next image, 15? Is that him, like, heading into the water?
That is later in the day on a smaller cliff. Same guy.
It's a smaller cliff.
Jump off. Yeah, this one's only like maybe 50 or 60 feet tall. The other one... It was a much taller cliff. So he just jumped off because they were so comfortable after climbing on these cliffs for so many days. Just 40 or 50 foot jump into the water wasn't a big deal.
God. I mean, if you're going to get some cool shots, find some idiots to take pictures of, right?
Well, I mean, these guys are the best in the world. And I think that's actually a key part of it. If you want to do any kind of sports photography, you got to find people that can do amazing stuff.
Yeah, who are willing to take those risks to do the average person won't do.
And for them, these aren't risks. These are just part and parcel of their day. For you and me, this would be extremely risky, like that mountain biking stuff. But for them, you know, they're very calculating. They know exactly what they can do and what they can't do. And just like, you know, a pro football player or a soccer star who can, you know, do a kick over his head. For me and you to try that, we'd probably break our necks. But before, you know, the guy who's been playing soccer since he was 4 years old, he can do that on demand all day long. And that definitely, you know, that's a big part of my images, is working with the best people I can get. And a lot of these guys in the outdoor world are pretty famous, just because they've done crazy stuff.
You know, I can tell some of the stuff is just absolutely insane. Like the last one, he doesn't look that high off the ground. That'd be image 27, but it's still, you know, it's a great shot right there. And finding someone who could actually climb up that to get to that point, most people couldn't do that.
No, well. That's a pretty hard problem, but it's not like the hardest problem in the world. So there's a fair number of people that could do that thing. But yeah, it's just an exciting moment. And, you know, he's only 10 feet off the ground. So if he falls off, it's not a big deal. Unless he falls off wrongly. Wrong. But yeah, I mean, and that's our job as photographers, is to make something look exciting so we can share the experience, you know, and show it the way it is to somebody. So like, they take a second look at the image for a little longer than they normally would.
You know, I think a lot of people take their sports photos, their kids, and, you know, or when they're out camping and trying to do these things, and they're just not coming out really well. They're not showing a good sense of adventure or a good sense of movement. How are you really capturing it? What's a good technique that people can use to really make that image go to the next level when it comes to trying to capture that essence of action?
Well, I think this goes back to like just creating a good solid image overall, and action is a part of it. So, A, you have to have good light. That's one of the easiest things people can do if they want to make their images better. Wait for good light. You know, I mean, in a soccer game or some event, you know, if it's in the middle of the day, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. But if you have control of something, say, okay, this is great, let's come back, let's do it at, you know, sunset. Composition is the next thing, which can be learned pretty easily. Watch the, you know, go see a movie. There's tons of great composition in those. Look at other pictures and just work on it, shoot a lot of pictures. And then in terms of capturing the movement, I think that's something that can be learned too, but it's definitely, it's just you got to look really hard. And sometimes, you know, you can't really see it all. And you just have to blast away in short bursts. And you might see it on, you know, when you're processing or editing the images later, and you didn't see it there. Or it might be the opposite. You might have seen it, and then you want to try and capture it. So that's a big part of capturing the movement. And then having, you know, a fast camera with great autofocus certainly helps as well.
Because you have some shots from the motor, or not motorcycle, like trail bikes and people on different types of bikes, and some of them have, you know, obviously an intentional blur to them, where others are completely frozen in time. How do you choose which kind of mood to go for?
A lot of it's dictated by the light. In terms of, you know, if it's dark and I can actually do a blur, then that kind of makes sense. Or a lot of times I'll shoot it both ways. I'll shoot it, you know, so it's crisp and sharp and there's no motion and see what it looks like, which digital cameras is great because we can actually see the images. And then I'll decide, well, it might look better as a blur. Like some of the surfing stuff that I shot, I think it's image 23. I've been shooting all day and was getting some pretty nice images, but I tried this blur. And this was like at 9 o'clock at night in Hawaii. And, you know, there was barely any light left at all. The shot was at least a half second, maybe a full second, just panning with the surfer. And I think that shot conveys the experience more than any of the shots I got where they're fully static, you know, with a big wave above them.
That's a very cool photo with that silkiness texture to that wave coming over. It's not something you ever really see in a surfing shot.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big lens, like a 600 f4 on a tripod, so, and I blasted it away. I mean, I shot at 8 frames per second for 10 minutes or so at that shutter speed, and, you know, might have gotten only 2 or 3 shots that were sharp enough. Because nothing's really sharp in the image.
One of the things that, you know, pretty much would stand out for all these is really understanding what it is that you're shooting so that you can have that proper sense of timing.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, even if you don't understand what you're shooting, I think if you watch really closely, you can figure out what is the key movement or the key, you know, thing, especially with a mountain bike. If somebody throws some trick in the middle of the air, well, you know, okay, that's the moment. You know, if a surfer drops into a big wave and you see the big wave curling up over them, then that's the moment. Or rock climbing. Rock climbing is a little tougher because with rock climbing, you know, there's lots of movement, but it's very slow and static unless there's some kind of dynamic movement where they jump somewhere. It's not as obvious as it can be with some of the other sports. But it's the same in football or, you know, basketball or any of that stuff. When the action's really popping, that's it.
So understanding that, getting your timing down, getting your panning with the subject down, those are the things that's going to help you, you know, get those really good shots, is not just trying to hold it perfectly still and get it. Sometimes you're going to have to move with the subject to really nail those shots.
Definitely. And I think that, you know, not every picture has to be perfectly crisp and sharp. And so, I mean, look at one of the most famous pictures in the world, Robert Capa's picture on D-Day. When those guys landed on the beach, it's totally kind of blurry. But it tells the story of being there as those guys hit the beach and were getting shot at. And, you know, it's still an amazing picture, even though technically it may not be the sharpest picture you've ever seen.
That's good. Good point. You know, as long as you're telling the story and conveying what's happening, that can be more important than the technical aspects of the photo itself.
Definitely. And I think, you know, obviously you need to know how your camera works, you know, and play around with it, experiment, you know, especially if you're going to start using flashes and strobes. That's a lot of experimentation to get to the point where you can on demand say, I want to throw some light into this picture. And make it work without, you know, spending a half an hour setting it up and then getting nothing. So,
Well, let's talk about workflow for a little bit. I mean, you said you do your backups. You've got the Epson drives. I use the Wolverine, same type of thing. And now, we know we're RAW Shooter and we're Nikon. So the next big decision is Photoshop or Lightroom.
I use Lightroom mostly because the editing in Lightroom is much faster than it is in Photoshop or anything else I've used. I think Photo Mechanic actually can edit faster in Photo Mechanic, but I don't really like the way the previews look, so I choose Lightroom over that. And Lightroom just integrates with Photoshop extremely well, so that, you know, that gives it a couple more thumbs up there. So download the pictures into Lightroom, edit the pictures, which can take quite a while, and then drop into the develop module and start processing images. And once I've got those processed, I export all the images in out of Lightroom and open them into Photoshop to finish them off. In my workflow, I found that, you know, you can get an image so far in Lightroom, it's not going to be 100% finished in Lightroom normally. So there's a few things, just levels, adjustments, and, you know, maybe a few other little retouching things that I'll do in Lightroom. Just depends on the image.
So what percentage of shots end up being touched in some way in Photoshop?
Well, pretty much all of them have at least a level adjustment or curves or something like that that happens in Photoshop. But actual retouching where I'm, you know, unless it's dust spots or something, which is pretty rare, I'm not doing a whole lot of retouching, except for some of the portraits where I do touch up some of the faces a little bit. I try to keep things as raw and real as possible. So, you know, if you look at my images, they're not obviously Photoshopped in any way. I'm not, like, putting surfers in different places or whatever.
No, they...
extreme Photoshop work.
Yeah, they look extremely natural. David, did you want to... You were going to toss something in?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. Like, one of the big things that I had learned shooting the X Games and is that... I lived, ate, and breathed the sport and was completely into it. So I found that, like you were mentioning, being able to hang out with the athletes, and in my case, I actually went on tour with them for a few months, that really helped understand the sport. Is that something that you would encourage people that are thinking about making that leap into sports photography so they can understand when the grab happens during the trick or when the right moment is when they're surfing, things like that?
Definitely. I mean, most of the people I photograph are good friends or very close friends of mine. And I think anybody, if you have access, like you did with the X Games, you know, most of these images come from trips where we spend anywhere from a week to 2 weeks or sometimes a month, you know, in these different locations. And a lot of, as a professional, a lot of the stuff that you sell isn't necessarily the action stuff. It's the lifestyle stuff, those moments that happen in between. So,
yeah, I remember that.
Definitely. I mean, what kind of stuff did you shoot for the X Games?
I was doing inline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was doing a lot of the inline skating, some skateboarding as well. It was a blast. I mean, I'm a total adrenaline junkie, so as I'm sitting here listening to some of the stories that you're sharing about the different shots that you've captured, I'm just like, oh, man, if I could just carry this guy's bags. I mean, bring it on. I mean, I'll get on my motorcycle and go through, you know, triple digits. I'm the guy that, let's put it this way. I'm the photographer that made the athletes nervous. They were like, dude, you got to back up. We're worried we're going to get, you know, hurt you if we wipe out. I'm like, bring it. Like, I can handle it.
Yeah, I've gotten hit by mountain bikers. I've nearly gotten hit by surfers. You know, rock climbers, it's pretty easy to stay out of the way, but you're definitely in the way sometimes. And, yeah, I mean, that's, I think it's more a lifestyle as a photographer, just like it is to be it for the lifestyle for the athletes. And that's where the adventure outdoor stuff is nice that way, because I don't really shoot that many events, so I have full control. So I can say, look, I want, you know, I can be like the general out there, like organizing the troops. I'm like, okay, you're there, let's go, now, action. So it's kind of like, you know, being on a movie set to some degree, even though there's not nearly as many people involved. Whereas, like, in the X Games, you've got one position, I think. I don't know how it works. And you don't have as much control, though you can still get some amazing shots, for sure.
Oh, it was it was pretty intense. That's one genre of photography that I could handle definitely getting back into, because it's just such a rush. And you know when you got the shot, and now with digital, with the instant, like, I know I got it. Look, there it is. Like, oh.
Yeah. And honestly, that's a huge, for me and some of them, I mean, you can see some of these athletes are taking pretty huge risks. Even though for them it may not be a huge risk, there's definitely some of those pictures in there where they were pushing the envelope. And if I can look at the back of the camera and say, we got it, it's sharp, we're done, that's it, we're out of here, that can be the difference between somebody going home safe and somebody like being in the hospital. Whereas with film, you just shot it and said, oh, let's do it a couple more times just to make sure we got it. That's definitely a huge bonus for shooting digitally.
What I think is very interesting about your work is there are a lot of shots on here that the average person might have thrown away because they're not perfectly sharp, or they have some motion blur to them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you've kept those, and looking at them in the context of the rest of the images, they fit.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I'm kind of known for. You know, there's a lot of blur, shots that are blurred intentionally and then using strobes to give a sharp image. Speed blurs or pan blurs, whatever you want to call them. Just so I can show the motion and add a little drama to the image, and then you get this ghosting effect around the person, either backpacking or mountain biking or whatever.
A little dragging the shutter action going on.
Exactly. It's just, you know, shoot a tenth of a second and whatever aperture you need and experiment a bunch. Yeah. I've been on assignments where I'm doing that, and it's very experimental, and you get, you know, a very small number of images that are what you really want. And the art director will be standing there like, what are we doing? But, you know, just hold on. Wait and see. And then they see the images, and they're just like, wow, that's amazing. I never would have thought.
I know one question that's going to come up as soon as we get this out there and people look at your photography. They're going to go, okay, I've gone out, I've got some crazy shots of people doing some crazy stuff. What do I do with these images? How do I sell them? Who do I sell them to? How do you get started?
The best answer I've come up with that is that editorial is usually the best way to start getting into a market, so magazines. And these days, you know, especially in the adventure world, there's magazines for pretty much all these sports. So if you can start getting your images out to magazines, you just go to Borders or Barnes & Nobles or whatever bookstores near you, or go online and type in the magazines you're thinking about. And you can get the information, like the address and the phone number and email address of all these photo editors of different magazines, and you just email them and say, hey, I've got some images I think might be of interest to you. How do I submit them? And definitely send an email, you know, asking how to submit images before you just, you know, email them 15 gigabytes worth of images or something. And then see what happens, you know, and they'll give you pretty honest feedback pretty quickly. They'll either ignore it or they'll be like, oh, these are great. We can definitely use these. And then that, you know, that kind of gets your foot in the door. And, you know, the web's a great way to get your stuff out there. If you want to become a pro photographer, I think the website's kind of the home base for everything. Everything pretty much goes back to the website.
Is it good for people who are starting off to be able to write text to go along with the photos?
It can help, but it's not a requirement by any means. I would say if you have phenomenal images, you're going to sell them one way or the other if you're really proactive. But the thing, it's not easy to license an image, and the terminology here gets a little wacky, because selling an image, you know, it's not like you sell the image and somebody buys it and they own it. You want to avoid that. You're basically licensing the usage for that image in the magazine for that one issue so that you can license it over and over and make money off of it multiple times. A lot of times they'll just pick, especially in the outdoor world, they'll just pick a single image and say, this is phenomenal. We'll print this in one of our galleries or something like that.
Something like the Patagonian Expedition Race, that may not be something that, you know, only needs one image. You could do a whole spread about that particular thing. And if you were able to write some text about it and actually write the story of the race, you may be able to do even better than just trying to sell some images.
Definitely. I mean, that's definitely the case. And there's actually an article coming out in Nikon World Magazine any day now about the race that they're doing. And I helped write part of it. But, you know, and actually in my, I write these newsletters, which is one of my promotional things. They're like little mini PDF magazines that people can download on my website under the newsletters link. And there's a whole story on that adventure race. It's like 12 pages long with images and text. And I use those to help sell the stories to clients, to a magazine. If I've already got like a written, finished piece, or at least something that gives them an idea, that can help out. But back to your question, I mean, you can always bring a writer. Or you can always work with somebody who can write if you're not like, you know, the greatest writer on the planet. And most of the time, if the magazine's going to assign you a story, they're going to send a writer along with you. They don't expect you to write the story as well, because it's two totally different things when you really get into it, I think.
I think when you're at a certain level and you're being hired to go out and cover something, on the other side, when you're just trying to get your foot in the door and trying to get up to that level and being able to do it, anything extra to get noticed, it's not going to hurt.
Definitely. Well, I mean, in this day and age, if you have the ability to shoot video or, you know, do something more than just stills, that's also a bonus, I think.
Oh, yeah. A lot of these, like, outdoor photographer could put some video on their website if you had something good.
Yeah, and that's something I'm just starting to deal with myself.
Well, too bad you don't have a 5D Mark II.
I know. Nikon actually came out with the first digital camera with video, the D90.
Yeah, but it's only 780.
Yeah, I understand. Soon to come out with something on par. No, I hear you.
We had to get that slam in there somewhere.
But I mean, back to the workflow thing, I think part of my whole workflow ideology or thinking is that what you do in the camera when you're shooting affects the picture just as much as what you do in post-processing. And when I teach workshops, this is something that I try to pound in people's heads. But you know, you got to know what you're going to do in the post-processing to know how to shoot to some degree. So if you're going to, you know, shoot at super high ISO, you can know that, oh, I'll use Noise Ninja to remove some of the noise, or I'm shooting with a Nikon D700, which barely has any noise, so it doesn't matter. Or things like that you just have to think about. And, you know, if you can expose the image correctly, you can do all these things in the camera that just make it easier on the back end and vice versa.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the workshops, because I know you have that and you have some books that you've written. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those so people can look that up and maybe buy something from you?
Sure. Well, with the books, let's start there first. I've had a book that I've written. It's been out there. It's not a real book. It's an e-book. It's called Adobe Photoshop Lightroom, a Professional Photographer's Workflow. It's a 124-page e-book that you can buy on my website for $24.95. And it basically covers my entire workflow from start to finish in excruciating detail. And it also talks about Lightroom in great detail as well. So if you want to learn about how to use Lightroom, it's a great thing for that. And it starts out, you know, just like I was saying, in camera, talking about how I set up the camera. And it's Nikon specific, but it transfers pretty easily to Canon or any other system. How I shoot, you know, white balance in the camera, all that stuff, then goes through and in insane detail talks about every aspect of backing up images and processing them and that whole thing and how delivering them, pretty much everything I could think of. And it's basically a workshop in book form. And you can get it on the website. And I have another book that's coming out this fall, Digital Masters Adventure Photography, published by Lark Books. That's basically the first book on adventure sports photography that I can see. There's a few people who have written stuff about it, but not like a how-to guide. So this book's coming out this fall. It's also $24.95. I think it's even available on Amazon right now, if people want to check it out. Or you can actually, there's a link on my website that gives you more detail about the book and what it covers. But it goes pretty in-depth on basically how to do my job. Even the last two chapters talk about what you know, basically what we've been talking about. What do I do if I want to start selling my images or GoPro? And then...
And talk.
Yeah, I'm going on forever here, sorry. But
then right.
Workshops. I've got a few workshops this fall that are both in October. One here in Santa Fe, where we'll be actually photographing at the Balloon Fiesta.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Hot air ballooning. Which is, that's a phenomenal event to photograph.
It's one of the biggest ones in the country.
It's the biggest one in the world, I believe. There's like over 1,000 balloons taking off at, you know, at dawn. It's a dream for a photographer, color-wise.
That's beautiful.
So that'll be one of the workshops. And then I think one of the others is the Nikon Mentor Series Workshop in Philadelphia, which is a lighting workshop, talking about using their little speed lights and then larger strobes. And that's the only two I have lined up this year, but I also do privates every once in a while if somebody wants to do one.
I was just going to ask if you did some one-on-one like that. If you did one-on-one, do you take them out into the field with some athletes and kind of give them an idea like, okay, this is how intense this could really be at that point?
Definitely. It depends on their skills, but if they're totally custom. I do probably 3 or 4 of them a year, and you know, for 1 or 2 days. And we can, you know, go shoot landscapes if that's what they want to, you know, discuss or deal with. Or I can get some of the pro athletes that are even in my pictures on the website and go to these phenomenal places and,
wow,
you know, do what I do with them. Hang them off a cliff or anything they want to do.
And, got your camera?
I think it's great.
I need to get my camera.
Yeah, I think the custom ones, honestly, from teaching workshops, I got to say a one-on-one or, you know, a couple students, you can get through so much more ground than just a day or two, more than you probably can in a 5-day workshop.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it's probably cheaper in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, this has been interesting. I really like your work. I think it's going to be inspiring to some people to try and do some different things. And I recommend, as people are going through your website and looking at the images, that they look at a lot of the angles, because that's certainly a theme that you have, is you don't have a lot of standard angles. Everything is at sharp angles. There's a lot of the triangles that you'll find in there that are helping the composure look really good. And that seems to be kind of a, I don't know if it's a defining characteristic of your work, but it certainly is an ongoing theme through a lot of your work.
Definitely. I mean, I think there was Kent Coverstein, the old National Geographic photo editor, who was like, I remember him saying, if you haven't shot it from 360 degrees around the subject, then you haven't really covered it. So it's like, what does it look like if I shot where my angles are, or if I get above the person, or, you know, if I move back, if I move really close to the wide-angle lens? I mean, I think it's very interesting for people to see. If they saw all the outtakes for a couple of those pictures, there's a lot of variety there until I find that one angle that really just makes it work.
Yeah, I mean, there's bike shots taken from the ground. There's climbers from above, from below, from the side, from, you know, direct angles, bikes from every possible angle. And that's what people need to really experiment with, is looking at things from a different perspective and from a different viewpoint instead of what the typical person would expect to see. And those are the shots that really tend to stand out, is when it's not something that you would tend to see. Like, there's a cover for Sierra magazine. Obviously the camera was probably on the person or strapped to the center post of the bike,
yeah,
to get that forward
bike
looking. And that's not a typical viewpoint that someone's going to have. And it makes that image stand out even more.
Definitely. I mean, that's what photography is, basically. It's a problem solving exercise. It's like, okay, if I want to do something that gets me this picture, how do I do that? You know, and in that case, it was mounting the camera on the seat post. And that was me on the bike, you know, just riding around for an afternoon on a trail that wasn't all that exciting, but it looked cool in the picture.
And you sold it.
Yeah, multiple times.
And that's what counts, right?
You know, it was actually a picture shot on film quite a while ago. Still selling.
Very nice.
We've got a great action shot of Carrie on a bike.
Oh, yeah, let's not go there. Well, I wasn't on the bike. I was going over the handlebars of the bike.
Oh, man. Ouch.
And then me standing there going, oh, and people going, are you okay? And me going, no, I'm really hurt. No, I'm really hurt. When you say you're not okay, you're probably not okay. I learned that. Well, Michael, I really want to thank you for your time. I know I'm inspired to get out there and try some different things and just push stuff a little bit further than I normally do. I mean, I do a lot of weddings and products. I don't do a lot of hanging off cliffs, but you don't need to do that to get some exciting images. And I think that's what people should try and get from this is you don't have to go extreme. Just do something different. Try something outside of your comfort zone. Try these extreme angles and see what you can come up with.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what you're shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah, for any subject, just try something different and experiment a lot. And I guess we should throw the website in here. It's michaelclarkphoto.com.
Yes, I will have that in the show notes and everywhere else so that they can follow along as we go through this little adventure with you. And again, I want to thank you for your time. And when you have something new coming out, a new book or a workshop or something, be sure and let us know so we can help you promote it.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's our pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, Michael. We'll talk at you later.
All right. Have a good day.
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. This has been Carrie Garrison, and you can follow the show at cameradojo.com. Please participate in the forums. They're getting really active. You can also follow the show on twitter.com/cameradojo. And you can find my work at carriegarrison.com or twitter.com/carriegarrison. And for David, who can't make it for the exit here, but was there for the show, we want to thank you for listening, and we will catch you next week.